Yep. Morning, Rabbi Sai. Continuing our inyonim of having a haircut or cutting hair, etc., which we'll be doing for the next few days until we start in Yom Hashem Hilchas Chanukah Shloshim Yom Koyom Achag. So the question of combing payas, right? Is there a chashash that if you comb your payas, that some of the hair will get pulled out? So here's an interesting difference. Some poskim say that it's also to comb payas with a comb, if hair will come out. If every time a person combs his payas through, he finds in the comb afterwards that there are hairs there, then he knows that he's going to, by what's called, by combing his payas, he's going to be pulling out hairs which will be pulled out from the root.
Where's the issue in pulling out hair? There is issue to cut hair.
There's an issue, what?
No,
the issue is loisashkis, is to destroy it. The issue is, you're not allowed to pull out all your hairs either. Okay, yeah. Today there are laser treatments, though. I wonder how they work, and whether or not they're bechlal
the
yisur.
They kill the root.
Well, that's just interesting. Yeah, it says that some poskim say it's also one to comb his payas if it will pull out hairs, as we find that a nozir is not allowed to comb his hair, mishum chashash that he might pull out a hair, and he's got an issa also of giluach.
That's for a
nozir. Okay. However, most poskim hold that one may comb his payas. Chazam Sofer has a long tshuva on it, and the minig is to be mekel that a person may comb his payas during the week. What about Shabbos? Yeah. So there it says as follows: one may not use a comb on the hair on Shabbos, since it's almost certain that a hair may come out. Uh-huh. And here we're talking about, of course, they're both chashashim, chashoshois of issur d'oraisa. Yeah, but on Shabbos it's an issur skila. That's for everybody, right? That would be for a lady as well.
A brush as well.
That'd be a lady hole. A comb, a brush, right? Yeah, a comb, a brush, anything like that, because it will pull her hair. It says, and the Shuas Yaakov writes, yeah, that every rov should caution the people in his town about this, and therefore you can't sort out curl your payas, yeah, on Shabbos with a comb, but he says as well that even if there was no concern of actually pulling out the hairs, there may be an issa derabbanon of uvda dechol. Okay, the uvda dechol is something we come across a lot in the dishra, we come across it a lot in halacha. It's very difficult for us to know exactly what is the gedder of uvda dechol, because it's something that you do regularly during the week. But we eat during the week, and we walk during the week, and we do lots of things during the week that we do on Shabbos as well. Yeah. So what is it, uvda dechol? I don't know, but it says, accordingly, combs are mukta. According to that, if you say that the uvda dechol is an issa d'rabbanon, then he says that, therefore, according to that, a comb will then be mukta, because a keli that you cannot use for any heta on Shabbos is mukta. You can use it, by the way, for heta. If you wanted to, I don't know what you would do with a comb. Scratch your back. Okay. Well, there you've got a chashash, maybe you're going to wound yourself, I don't know. But if you wanted to scratch your back lightly with a comb, yeah, or for whatever it is, then that would be a keli shemalachto le'issa, which you're allowed to use the tzorech gufo and the tzorech mekoymoi. If the comb is lying on the table and it's in the way of your Shabbos table because somebody left a comb there, then you're allowed to pick it up and remove it because a keli shemalachto le'issa. But all he's saying is, and the final thing he says is, that one may not use gel or sugar water to style your payas on Shabbos, right? That's a separate issue, nothing to do with cutting the payas, and in fact you can't even use it to style your fringe or to style anything else, right?
Why not?
I don't know, I'll look in the Bi'ah Halacha in Siman Shein Gimel, and I'll let you know tomorrow, Eliezer.
A special brush.
Very soft. Yeah. Started there, the Thoroughway, Northwest London. Right. Thursday, Companies, Feshman, 13th November, Rabbi Shaw, Rosenblatt, Schlitter, Hillel, and the Calendar.
This takes over one of my family, Brody, the Chalitzimus of Mitzvah of Tzvi Brody. This coming Shabbos, Yerot, and Shizko, Rob, was going to be Rav Nachas. Yemenim, Akulia, Tzeichel, Atzehem. This Chus, our founder, Yosef Dov, Ben. Reb Shimon, Michal, Tzvi, Itzchel,
Yeah, we'll do it. Just black.
black, tea, please. Black. No, coffee.
Coffee, black.
Just say a little tefillah before we start, if we may. I couldn't find a parking space and my wheels were a little bit over a WL line. I figured this time, who's going to get a ticket? But I just saw two parking guys walking up the road. So, Shem Yazor, if you can have in mind that Shem looks after me, I would appreciate it. Pardon? They do, yeah, I guess so. Let's see. We'll see. I'm sure Hashem will be good to me. I thought just something a little bit different, a bit interesting today to work the Jewish calendar. It's something I've been eyeing more deeply in recent years, and there's a lot of interesting things that I find that people don't always know about. For example, let me ask you guys the question. Where every month we announce the Molad in Shul. Anybody tell me what the Molad is?
The
what?
Birth of the moon.
Well, birth of the moon. But what scientifically, what is it? What happens on the Molad scientifically? Where's the moon? It's not actually that complicated, the Molad itself.
Other side of the globe.
Pardon?
Other side of the globe coming over.
Okay, you're kind of along the lines. In simple terms, and it's three-dimensional, so it's a little bit more complicated than this, but the moon goes around the Earth. That one's easy enough. And therefore, sometimes you have it lined up that the moon is over here, the Earth is in the middle, and the sun is on the other side. And what would we call that?
Eclipse.
No. Moon here, Earth here, sun there. That is called a full moon. That's the full moon. Because you have the sun shining on the full face of the moon, and from the Earth you can look out at the moon and the sun's over there and it shines on the full face of the moon. That's a full moon. The Molad, and this isn't, I'm going to say a statement isn't correct, but I'm going to correct it in a minute. The Molad is the opposite, is when you have Earth here, moon here, sun there, and therefore you can't see the moon at all. The moon is completely invisible. Because the sun is behind it, so to speak, shining on the opposite face of it, and therefore there's no reflection of the moon to the Earth. There's no angle of reflection for the moon to reflect the sun's light onto the Earth. So, and now there's another axis, and horizontally they're not necessarily the same, but the moon kind of shifts a little bit on the axis, and if you have them exactly in line, Earth, moon, sun, and on the same plane, what would you call that? Earth, moon, sun, the same plane. That is indeed a solar eclipse. That is indeed a full solar eclipse because the moon blocks the sun's light from coming to the Earth. The Earth is 400 times the size, the sun is 400 times the size of the Earth, and it's 400 times further away than the moon. And therefore the moon appears in our skies, as you know, the same size as the sun. Because of that difference in size and distance, and therefore when it comes across the sun, it blocks it entirely. The just want to share thoughts with you. This will be your last chance for probably 100 years or so to see an amazing solar eclipse. August the 12th, 2027, there's going to be a solar eclipse that's going to go across North Africa. It'll touch on Gibraltar, North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, coming down Saudi Arabia. Those are the places to go see it. And if you really want, the last place it is in Yemen. Yemen's another option. If you're interested in a visit to Yemen, you can go and see the solar eclipse there. But I recommend it very highly because there is no solar eclipse like this anywhere in the world, actually. Certainly not in the Western Hemisphere, certainly not in the Western Northern Hemisphere, for many, many decades to come. This will probably be the last chance in your guys' lifetimes and mine to see one. There's another one in 2026, but it's only a minute and a half. This one is going to be a six-minute solar eclipse. I've been to a solar eclipse in 2017 in Oregon. I went to one in 2024 in Vermont. A big fan of solar eclipses. And they are Niflasa Boira like you've never seen. I have never had an experience of Niflasa Boira like a solar eclipse. So I want to recommend to you guys, August 12th, 2027, if you get the chance, put in your diaries, see if you can make it there. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu, melech ha'olam she'kol nivra. So, I said something mistaken here, but I'll correct it now. I said that the Molad is when the earth, the moon, you have earth, moon, sun. Not quite correct. Because how long does it take for the moon to go around the Earth? There you go. 29 and a half days. It's not quite correct. That's an approximation. It's actually 29.53 days. And that itself is an approximation. And that's the problem with the MOLAD. Not problem with the MOLAD. It's the limitation of the MOLAD. Actually, because the moon does not go around the Earth consistently. And at different months, it takes different times. And the range is between 29.18 days and 29.93 days. That's the range. Which is doesn't sound like very much. Look, point this, that, and the other. Ends up being a range of 18 hours difference. So the actual, what we call conjunction, that's what it's called scientifically, the conjunction where you have a straight line of Earth, Moon, Sun, could be 9 hours before the MOLAD, or it could be 9 hours after the MOLAD. The MOLAD is the average time. So yes, 29.53 days is the average time it takes for the Moon to go around the Earth, but it's not the time that it is each month. Each month is going to be a little different. And it seems to me, having done my research, that Chazal, whilst they knew this, they didn't know the scientific calculations of this. And therefore, they were not able to calculate every month exactly when the moment of conjunction was. They only knew an approximation of the MOLAD. That's all they knew. Now, their understanding of 29.53 days and whatever fraction it was is accurate to within 0.00001% of NASA's present calculations. So it's pretty impressive what they knew from observation at that time. I mean, how do you get it so accurate standing here on Earth and just watching the moon go around the Earth? It's fascinating that you can get it that accurate, but indeed they did. But it's not the exact amount of time, which I'm going to come to in a minute, causes certain challenges and certain problems, potentially.
Even though when we announce the MOLAD, we actually mention how many chalokot.
Yes, because we say that what we do is, from one Rosh Chodesh, this is how the calendar's set up, so it's our present-day calendar, from one Rosh Chodesh, we count 29.53, whatever it is, days, and then we say, that's the next MOLAD. That doesn't mean it's when the Earth and the Moon and the Sun are in line. It's just a number from the previous MOLAD. And we have calculations from the very first MOLAD, which was prior, I believe, if I remember correctly, to Sheshis and Mebrashis, even, or prior, certainly prior to the creation of the moon in the sky, the first MOLAD. We have a fixed date that we started counting from, very first MOLAD, which I believe is pre-Sheshis and Mebrashis. It's a fixed date in time. It was picked as a date to start the MOLADs from. Yes.
The moon was only created on the 7th.
I know. Let's not go into that one. It's fascinating how that works. It's just it's a fixed date for the mathematical purposes. It's not a fixed date that is when the first MOLAD was. But that's a more complicated discussion. So I don't want to go into that. So the way that we calculate Rosh Chodesh, however, is not scientifically, as we know, or at least it wasn't, and it's not meant to be. Hashem said to Moshe, "Achodesh azel lachem Rosh Chodeshim." This is how we calculate this. But I feel Shagagim says the Brisa, I think it is, not Mishnah Brisa, Filo Mazidim. Even if the Sanhedrin get it wrong by accident, even if they purposely decide to make it on a different day than it should be, that is when our Rosh Chodesh is. That is the halachic definition of Rosh Chodesh, is the date that the Sanhedrin fix it on. And of course, then you have the whole famous story of Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua, where Rabbi Yeshua thought and believed correctly that the Edim were lying and that they couldn't have come that early. He knew when the actual conjunction was, not the Moilad was, and he said they were here too early, and etc. That whole story as it plays out, which ultimately tells us that story. When Sanhedrin fix it, that is what it is, and that is what Rosh Chodesh is. Now, I don't want to talk too much about Today Yom Tov, but it is relevant, just as a little side point. Once, obviously, you have fixed the month, the Sanhedrin's fixed the month, they need to be able to tell everybody outside of Eretz Yisrael when the new month is, because you need to know, obviously, for the Chagim. And the new month could be on one of 2, maybe even 3 days, possibly, it could have been fixed on. And so they would tell people. Now if they sent messengers, anybody have any idea to get to, let's say, Sur and Pumbedisa, how long would it have taken in those days to send messengers to Bovil? How long would it take them to get there? 850 kilometers or so. 3 days. Any other options? Any offers on that? 2 weeks?
3 hours.
3 hours to get 850 kilometers? You can't do that today. I think in a modern fighter jet, maybe you could do it. The answer is, it would take a caravan of people traveling at a normal speed, about 6 weeks, to get from Yerushalayim to, let's say, Pumbedisa. If somebody, fast horseback messengers, you know, where they change the horses every so often, you could probably do it in 4 weeks. Fast as 3, but more likely 4 weeks. So you can see the problem over there. If it's going to take you 4 weeks to get there, you're not going to get anywhere near enough time to tell people when the Chagim are. That's a real challenge and a real difficulty. And like I said, I don't want to go too much into 2-day Yom Tov here, but that's obviously, that challenge is what created the idea of 2-day Yom Tov for us. However, the method that they used to use, as the Mishnah tells us, is Masir Masur, says it, as the Mishnah calls it. They would make fires. Now, can anybody tell me, if you do it by the fire method, everyone know what the fire method is, yeah? If you do it by the fire method, the beacons method, how long would it take to get the message to Sur and Pumbedisa from Yerushalayim if you used fires? Any ideas?
Same day.
The answer is 40 minutes, as little as 20 minutes. If you had an extremely efficient system, you could get it done in 20 minutes. If everyone was standing there watching and waiting and ready to light the fire the minute they saw the previous one, you're doing 20 minutes. It's quite a difference. 4 weeks down to 20 minutes.
How many stops?
Pardon? 30 or 40 stops. You'd have to have 30 or 40 stops along the way. And if each person took, let's say, a minute, you know, or less than a minute to do it, between, because as soon as you light the fire that comes up, the guy sees it on the next mountain. I mean, in theory, you're doing a few seconds. But obviously there's the human element that people don't quite see it, and it takes them a minute to get their fire together and light it. There's all sorts of possibilities.
So, pardon? Calculation or
no, this is a calculation. Yeah. But it's a practical calculation if you think about it. You think about how far people can see, and if you have two mountains, and how what's the visibility of a beacon, and so you see how many beacons you would need, and then how long would it take for the guy to see it and then light his own beacon, and for it to be big enough for the guy to see on the next mountain. It's not particularly long. So you see that the Kusim really messed us up. Those without the Kusim, we would have no concept of 2-day Yom Tov. You absolutely do not need 2 days Yom Tov if you have this means of communication of lighting fires. Chaval for us, these kusim, maybe chaval, maybe not chaval. Maybe 2-day Yom Tov is a good thing for us in Galus nowadays. Maybe spiritually it's a value for us. However, at a certain point in time, so it's the responsibility of the Sanhedrin to set the new month for us based on Edim who come to see the new month. Now, I'll tell you something else interesting. At the time of the Sanhedrin, it was almost impossible. In fact, I would say it was impossible. Rashi seems to indicate that there is a possibility, but scientifically, it's hard to understand that, Rashi. It's almost impossible that the day of Rosh Chodesh would be on the day of the Molad itself. The day of Rosh Chodesh would inevitably be the day after. Anybody know why? The moment in other words, technically you want to be Mechadish the Chodesh as the moment after conjunction. The moment after conjunction, the moon is now visible, technically, and if you see it then, you make Rosh Chodesh right away. It would always be 24 hours later or more. What, anybody have any idea why? Why could you just physically, technically, scientifically not have a situation whereby you would make it at that time?
Messengers don't hear it.
No, seeing it, the Edim coming, the Edim seeing it.
Is there a 12-hour gap when the Edim and the moon can't be seen?
Yeah, that's right. The moon is not visible. Firstly, it's such a thin sliver at the moment of conjunction, the moment after conjunction, it's not visible to the naked human eye. It takes a little while after the conjunction for it to be visible. But secondly, here's the interesting thing, and to what extent you guys know this, at the time of Rosh Chodesh, at the time of the Molad, the moon and the sun are going to be together in the sky, as we know, because that's the conjunction. So the moon will be setting at the same time as the sun. As you know, or maybe you don't, the moon follows a similar pattern to the sun across the sky. The moon rises and sets. It just doesn't always rise and set at the same time as the sun, and therefore you don't. It's not always visible. Sometimes rising and setting when the sun's out in the sky, and therefore you can't see it rising and setting, but it does rise and set. At the time of conjunction, the moon and sun are rising and setting at the same time, and therefore you would only be able to see the moon while the sun's still out in the sky, and because it is set after that, and then it'd be invisible, be behind the horizon. And those two things together, the sun's still in the sky, the moon is a very thin sliver, impossible to be seen by the naked human eye for probably at least 12 to 18 hours afterwards, probably even more. Today, now that we have a fixed calendar, we can have Rosh Chodesh a day earlier. We can have Rosh Chodesh at the time of the Molad itself, which is an interesting just a nuance and a difference between setting it by the Sanhedrin and setting it by us. But obviously, once there is no Sanhedrin, you cannot have a calendar anymore. You cannot have Adim Kam anymore and fix the calendar. So anybody know when the Sanhedrin disappeared? This is a difficult question. It's not a question with a simple answer. 300. It's not bad, it's not bad, it's not bad, not bad, not bad, 300, 350. The last Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim, obviously, was 70 when Yerushalayim was destroyed, and there was no Sanhedrin there after that. As we know, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai relocated the Tenli Yavna v'Chachameha. He relocated the Sanhedrin to Yavna, and Yavna sat in Yavna. Sorry, the Sanhedrin sat in Yavna for quite a while after that. Around the 200s, there were obviously 130, 135 after the Bar Kokhba revolt. Jews were significantly exiled at that point. Jews were thrown out of the land of Israel, and there weren't as many Jews left in the land of Israel. The Sanhedrin diminished, its authority diminished once it moved to Yavna. But it seems like there was some sort of ad hoc, semi-functioning Sanhedrin, potentially even into the 500s, let's say. But I think 300, 350, 400 is not a bad time if you want to fix a time and say, no, this is when it ended. I don't think it ended from one day to the next. I don't think it was a Sanhedrin one day, and the next day there wasn't a Sanhedrin. It was that over time, it just sort of disintegrated, and they weren't able to hold it, and they hold it less regularly, and it just eventually fell apart. So once you don't have a Sanhedrin, what do you do? The Rambam says that it's built into the halacha that if there is no Sanhedrin, you can have a fixed calendar. He says it has to be, this is a chiddush in the Rambam himself. I'm not sure the other Rishonim, I have certainly seen no other Rishonim say this. He says it nevertheless has to be fixed by an authority in Eretz Yisrael. It has to be done from Eretz Yisrael, and it has to be set in Eretz Yisrael for the rest of the world. And if it's not set in Eretz Yisrael, according to the Rambam, it's possible and it's no good. But it doesn't need to be a Sanhedrin, and it does not need to be done nationally. Anybody in Eretz Yisrael can fix it, and you could probably have varying opinions in Eretz Yisrael fixing different calendars, which would create a big mess, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So everybody knows, who was it that fixed our calendar?
Hillel.
Hillel. Which Hillel?
Hillel,
he's known as Hillel the Second. Where does he appear in the Gemara, Hillel the Second? He does not appear in Chazal at all. We know nothing of this Hillel the Second. What date did he fix the calendar?
350.
Not bad. Not, that's closer. 358. Where do we know that from, 358? Where do we have that date from? So the first person that gives that date is a sefer called the Sefer Ibur. Sefer Ibur is written in 1123, something like that, in Barcelona, and it was about the calendar. And he mentions in there that that Hillel, he's the first person to say, as the first source we have, it's certainly not in Chazal, it's not in the Ga'onim, He's the first person who says that Hillel fixed the calendar in 358. The first one to talk about it. Now, there are even those that say that that wasn't in the early editions of the Sefer Ibor, and that that was a medieval addition to the Sefer Ibor, this name of Hillel, and the date of 358. So it's generally accepted, you'll find, as you guys all know, across the Orthodox world today, that that's the correct thing. However, there are challenges with that. There's problems with that, and I'll give you one specific example, but there are many. There was... In the Cairo Geniza, they discovered letters between a Nossi in Yerushalayim called Ben Meir, Aaron Ben Meir, and the Rosh Galusa in Bavel, from about 800 or 900 CE, arguing about what date Rosh Hashanah was that year. A difference of opinion: one says Rosh Hashanah was in this date, and the other says Rosh Hashanah is this date. Now, if you had a fixed calendar by Hillel from the date 358, how can they possibly have machlikas? And you see a number of these things going on where people are debating and discussing when Rosh Hashanah should be fixed for this year. When is it appropriate to fix Rosh Hashanah for this year? So even though we have that date and that idea, nobody's ever heard of this Hillel, like I say, other than this Sefer Ibor, which potentially is a medieval edition. But nevertheless, we kind of have that in our Masaira at this point, that it was this Nasi Hillel, whoever he was, who had a Sanhedrin L'chayra in Eretz Yisrael, and in 358 he fixed the calendar for us. Now, how does that work with him fixing a calendar for the future? According to the Rambam, and I don't know how the Rambam believes this to work, so don't ask me that question. But the Rambam says each year and each month really still needs to be Mekudesh by an authority in Eretz Yisrael. Even though Hillel's worked out the calculations for you and told you when it is, nevertheless, you need to be Mekadesh the Chodesh. The Chodesh needs to be Mekudesh, and if you don't Mekadesh it, it's not Mekudesh. And so, like I said, I don't know the details of how the Rambam would see that playing out. But the Sefer Chinuch has a different understanding of it, which is certainly simpler and easier, and he gets it from the Ramban. The Ramban says that what Hillel did was he proactively was Mekadesh every single Chodesh in his calendar from then and for time immemorial. And therefore Hillel was Mekadesh the Chodesh for us. And so if you ask, this coming Rosh Chodesh, who is Mekadesh it? Hillel in 358 was Mekadesh it for you. He did you a favor and he was Mekadesh Rosh Chodesh for you coming up in the week. Pardon?
That's not that.
Firstly, we have no power because we're not in Eretz Yisrael, and secondly, that's just a little thing that we have in Zeicher of the Kiddush HaChodesh, but it's not. This has no halachic power of being Mekadosh the Chodesh. Now another point is that and Hillel's calendar takes this into account. Hillel's calendar is an extremely accurate calendar. It loses one day every 88 years. One day every 88 years. As we all probably know, Pesach needs to be in the spring. And if it's not in the spring, it's posel. You cannot celebrate Pesach not in the spring. Chodesh Aviv, it's got to be the spring itself. In fact, Nisan itself needs to be in the spring. and without it, it's no good. But don't worry, the calendar is drifting. But it will take thousands of years before Pesach is outside of the spring. So we're all good. None of us are going to be around to face that challenge as and when it might arise. There's an interesting concept. There are four dechiyos that are used in this calendar. Hillel used four principles, some of them extremely complicated. But there's one simple dechiyah that he used. He did not want, it's called Lo Adu Rosh. He does not want Rosh Hashanah to be on either Aleph, On Sunday, Dalad, Wednesday, or Friday. Rosh Hashanah should not be in any of those days. Because the three things that we want to avoid, anyone knows what do we want to avoid with that? Yom Kippur on Friday. We don't want Yom Kippur on Friday. We don't want Yom Kippur on Sunday. Third one, people know less. We don't want Hoshana Rabbah to be on Shabbos. Because with Hoshana Rabbah on Shabbos, you could not do the Aravos. Now, it's interesting that they built a rule in the calendar for something that we know is only being a minhag the Aravos on Hashanah Rabbah. It doesn't seem like such a big deal. But they fixed the calendar so that there would never be a year where you wouldn't do those Aravos, where you wouldn't do the Hashanah Aravos. So it gives you a sense that there's something more significant than that. I have a lot more to say, but I just want to. I'll finish with one final point. I think the reason for this inaccuracy in Hillel's calendar is not because of inaccuracy in the calculation of the moon, which is interesting, but rather an inaccuracy in the calculation of the sun that the Christians had as well. Christians shared an inaccuracy in the understanding of the sun going around the earth going around the sun. How long does it take the earth to go around the sun? 365 and a quarter days. 365 and a quarter days. And in a sense, that makes it a lot simpler than Rosh Chodesh, because all you do is, you have 365-day year, and every 4 years you have a leap year to account for that quarter day. The problem is, it's a little bit less than a quarter day. It's not exactly a quarter day. And therefore, if you have a leap year, every 100 years or so, if you have just a calendar with a leap year every 4 years, every 100 years or so, the calendar will add an extra day. You'll add an extra day to the year. And it'll get out of sync by a day every 100 years or so, which is the idea of Hillel's drift as well. Now, as we know, the Christians had a problem with that, and their calendar drifted. The Julian calendar, which was set up by who? Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar fixed that calendar, hence it was known as the Julian calendar. Very accurate calendar, but not accurate enough. If you didn't take this into account, this extra little amount that's less than a quarter, and that calendar drifted, such that by 1587, I believe it was, certainly around that time, it was 10 days, it was wrong by 10 days.
11 days.
10, I believe, but it might be 11. And we'll see different opinions on that. We can discuss that later, but I believe it was 10. But I know I've heard people say 11 as well. But I need to look up exactly. But
give us back our 11 days.
Okay, yeah, it might have been 11. Anyway, 10 or 11 days. I'm happy to say 11, if and you may well be right. By 10 or 11 days, and what they did was they needed to readjust it, and they took 10, 11 days off the calendar, and people were very upset. They said, "You're taking your days off our lives, you know, superstitious people. You're taking days, and so we're going to live 10 days, 11 days less. You've taken our lives away," which is fascinating medieval view of how the world works. But what they've done is, to readjust that, anybody know how they fixed it? How did they fix the calendar so that this drift wouldn't happen? What did, it was Pope Gregory the 13th who did this. Hence, it is known as the Gregorian calendar after that pope. Anybody know how they fixed it? They fixed it by making it that if the year is divisible by 100, then it's not a leap year, even though it's divisible by 4, unless it's divisible by 400. And hence, the year 2000 was a leap year. Yeah, but 2100 will not be a leap year. So when you get there, you'll know. Warning in advance. Just in case any of you are around, 2100 is not a leap year. Don't get fooled by it. I have a lot more to say on this, but I think we're done. So it's been a pleasure, and maybe I'll come again and say a little more about it. I think it's an interesting idea, and thank you very much. Have a good day, everybody.
I heard that.